KALW.
It's this idea of graded inequality that you're born into.
Today, we learn about a measure to add caste to California's anti-discrimination laws.
Your caste status is sort of predicated on another caste being superior to you and inferior to you.
Now its fate is in Governor Newsom's hands. Then we'll hear readings from three local authors.
The story covers the exploits of a San Francisco building inspector. From his city, he's catapulted to the Mendocino coast, where a blue whale has been stranded outside Fort Bragg.
And we meet the senior citizens keeping Chinatown's old spirit alive by kicking up their heels.
Nowadays, when we come out in our fishnet stockings, we don't even have to get to the stage yet. People are like, whoa!
Whoa. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The California legislature has passed a first-in-the-nation measure to add caste to state anti-discrimination laws, and now it's in front of Governor Gavin Newsom. Senate Bill 403 is authored by Fremont Democratic Senator Aisha Wahab, and it would add caste to the list of protected classes in the state's civil rights, employment, and housing laws. Caste is an old social hierarchy system that's historically determined what jobs or education people can get. Opponents of the bill say the prevalence of caste in South Asian countries would lead to racial profiling. This all started when a Cisco employee alleged his superiors discriminated against him because he was a Dalit, the lowest rank in the caste system. To learn more, I spoke with KALW's Sonia Paul. She's been following this case and the bill. She reported a documentary on this for the BBC and an article in Mother Jones.
Back in 2020, in the middle of protests after the murder of George Floyd, news broke alleging caste discrimination at Cisco, specifically that a man, he was alleging that he had been discriminated against because of his caste. And actually, the California Civil Rights Department had filed that lawsuit on his behalf. And that case sort of set off this firestorm about caste in the diaspora. And immediately after, an advocacy organization called Equality Labs received over 250 other complaints of caste discrimination at other Silicon Valley tech companies. These were people here in the U.S. The Washington Post published an article about caste discrimination in the industry and featured an anonymous letter from a group of female Dalits in Silicon Valley alleging...
Can you say what Dalits means?
Dalit is the term that people formerly known as untouchable have reclaimed for themselves. It means broken or crushed, but instead of it being a term of oppression, it is meant to be a term that lifts them up, you know, a reclamation of an identity.
So is this the lowest caste then?
Yeah, this would be considered the caste that's actually so low or oppressed that it would technically be outside the caste system. A group of Dalit female engineers also put forward a statement alleging harassment, including sexual harassment in the workplace, and arguing for workplace protections. What was happening is the California Civil Rights Department went and filed the lawsuit, sort of arguing that in our current Civil Rights Act in the state, that Cisco was in the wrong. Cisco said caste discrimination is not illegal. Earlier this year, the California Civil Rights Department actually dropped its lawsuit against the two managers, but it's still pursuing its lawsuit against the company.
So then came the bill, Senate Bill 403. Tell me about how it came about. How did we get to a point that a senator introduced a bill about caste discrimination?
Yeah, so if we start back where we left off, where there's this announcement of the Cisco lawsuit, there's so much talk about caste discrimination. At that time, we also saw like a growing movement to add caste as its own protected category, specifically in colleges and universities. In California, you know, we had the California State University system add caste as a protected category. And then in February of this year, the city of Seattle actually explicitly added caste to their non-discrimination policy. And then we had SB 403, which came out just about a month after the announcement of Seattle. But there was also a lead up to that where Senator Aisha Wahab, who represents parts of Silicon Valley, you know, the hotspots where we've been hearing stories about caste discrimination, as soon as she came into office, she knew that she wanted to present this bill. This is what she said. She lives in the area. She's heard these stories. She thought it would be best, like, let's clarify the law once and for all, because we can make arguments, and some legal scholars have made these arguments, that caste is already inherent in our laws. Like, you can argue it as a form of race or national origin or ancestry.
There's also been a lot of opposition to this bill, a lot of, you know, very loud opposition to this bill. Tell me who is against it and why.
There are many people against the bill. The most vocal opposition has come from some Hindu groups or organizations and individuals who say that, A, instead of actually, like, getting rid of this system of hierarchy, you're bringing it back. You're going to recreate these hierarchies when they don't exist, right? And they're fearful of what that might do to communities, to kids who don't know anything about caste. And then there are a lot of groups who say specifically that this is going to make Hindus a target for bullying because of caste association with Hinduism in popular culture.
This opposition group has been really vocal. They've been coming to the hearings and making themselves heard. How has this affected the bill at all in terms of the language in the bill, for example?
You know, the bill becoming law has gone through a bunch of changes. And most notably, instead of adding caste as its own protected category of discrimination, caste is now being clarified as a subset of ancestry. So the definition of ancestry has evolved to include caste and inherited status. I think they also say, like, lineage, some other terms aside from just caste. The two lawmakers who actually suggested that language were Alex Lee and Evan Lowe, who represent parts of Silicon Valley, are Asian American lawmakers. Alex Lee identifies as a democratic socialist. So I think some people were also perplexed, like, why are they doing this? But, you know, maybe they're also listening to their constituents and figuring things out.
So, Sonia, in your article, you mentioned this interaction you had with someone while you were reporting outside the state capitol. I wanted you to tell that story.
There was a woman who came up to me and, you know, I asked her, oh, would you mind if I ask you a few questions? And she was like, sure, you know, what's your name? And I'm like, oh, my name is Sonia. And she's like, Sonia Paul, you're our enemy. Maybe they perceive, because I report on caste, this taboo subject, I am perpetuating things they don't want to be out in the public. But then she, like, gave me a hug, and she was like, I'll still give you a hug. And she used the words, because we're from the same Alawalia. And I was like, what's an Alawalia? And she just frowned at me, and she's like, it's a Gotra. And I was like, what's a Gotra? A Gotra is a clan, which basically is like a lineage within a caste. And so it felt like, you know, maybe she still felt some kind of affection for me because she thought I was part of her same family. Or here's this journalist, we don't really like her, but we're going to tolerate her the way we would like some family member. And I was just kind of befuddled because the reaction I was having is what opponents of the bill say that they hope won't happen to their children. All of a sudden, people are going to ask about their caste and they're not going to know how to react. Maybe for opponents of the bill, they're very afraid because caste is so taboo and it has sort of been a stain on South Asian culture, a stain that they want to get rid of and they don't want people to be stigmatized by. So there's just a lot of charged emotions when it comes to this bill and with the topic more broadly.
That's KALW's Sonia Paul. We've got a link to her documentary and articles on the caste discrimination case and bill at KALW.org.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, we'll hear readings in our series New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. Today, we're featuring three very different novels. The first is from Muazzam Sheikh. He's a librarian in San Francisco. His book is A Footbridge to Hell Called Love.
And here's an excerpt that gives a bit of good insight into the main character's frame of mind. Claire talked ebulliently with an older man he didn't recognize about an upcoming exhibition of hers at a gallery in Oakland. What little he could gather from her answers to the man's questions made it clear that Claire Gaskin had created several art pieces from photographs and personal mail found in her mother's bedroom after she passed away. Claire, too, had always fascinated Aslam with her intellect. Her project, he reflected, sounded so much like the way he wrote his fiction these days, while nurturing an abhorrence for the biographical. Though he admitted that everything a writer wrote stemmed from the personal, it was a delicate balance, how to make yourself invisible.
That was Muazzam Sheikh reading from A Footbridge to Hell Called Love. It came out in January. Our next reading is from an eco-mystery with an unlikely hero, a San Francisco building inspector. It's called The Rotting Whale. Author Jan Eyrick lives in Sonoma County.
The story covers the exploits of a San Francisco building inspector when, from his city, he's catapulted to the Mendocino Coast, where a blue whale has been stranded outside Fort Bragg. It begins. Hugo Sandoval, San Francisco's quixotic native son, stared out his kitchen window for reassurance. It calmed him to watch the dawn grace the little white houses of the city below, its gentle whispers of light bleeding through the fog, creating shadows on the eastern face of Russian Hill that to him resembled craters on the moon. He suspected it was a quietude not often found in major cities. While the building inspector waited for the dawn to take hold, the city yawned. Hugo was familiar with her stretches. They were soft, comforting, interrupted only by a cacophony of sounds from the waterfront below, where streetcars glided on slick rails, street sweepers swooshed the gutters clean, and the occasional wildlife car alarm barked from the sea lion's floating piers.
That was author Jan Eyrick reading from The Rotting Whale that came out this month. Finally, we'll hear from a Berkeley author, Yael Goldstein Love, in her novel New Motherhood Meets Science Fiction. The book is The Possibilities.
It's about the psychological experience of becoming a new mother, told through a multiverse suspense story. This passage takes place when Hannah is trying to figure out how to get her car key from up four flights of stairs without sending her son into a dramatic meltdown. And it sets into motion her quest through multiple realities. I poked my head out into the fluorescent glare. Back in, back out. Jack's face cracked wide. He laughed. He thought I was playing with him. Peekaboo, I said. It would take no more than 3 minutes. It was sane. I was sane. Admirably sane. Like a mother from the 1970s. I knew how sane I was until I reached the first landing. That's when I pictured Jack below, waiting, eager, thinking we were still playing and trusting me completely. That open-mouthed smile, always halfway to a laugh if it wasn't already mid-scream. Four flights of stairs with his torquing, thrashing body against my tiny one, but that was the sane choice. I saw that now and turned. I took the stairs back down two at a time, grabbed for the door, pulled it hard, smile already plastered over my face. Peekaboo! And he was gone.
That was Berkeley author Yael Goldstein Love reading from The Possibilities that came out in July. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. For more readings by local authors, subscribe to the New Arrivals podcast. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. This weekend, San Francisco's Chinatown will be hosting its annual Autumn Moon Festival. There'll be food vendors selling mooncakes, martial arts demonstrations, and dancing. In fact, from the 1940s till the 1960s, San Francisco's Chinatown was a dancing hub and home to a thriving Chinese-American nightclub scene. Clubs had names like Forbidden City, the Chinese Sky Room, and the Shanghai Lo. They had showgirls, comedians, jazz dancers, and magic. And these clubs had wide appeal. Celebrities like Bing Crosby, Duke Ellington, and Lauren Bacall were all spotted over the years, along with tourists, businessmen, and locals. The Forbidden City even inspired a musical, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Flower Drum Song, which was also made into a movie.
Grant Avenue, San Francisco, California, USA. Looks down from Chinatown over a foggy bay.
The scene died out in the 60s, but there's a group keeping the memory of those old Chinatown clubs alive. In this piece from our archives, reporter Jen Chien brings us the story.
Wednesdays are rehearsal days for the Grant Avenue Follies, a 12-member dance troupe that does tap, jazz, hula, and other styles. They perform 4 to 6 times a month. That may not sound like a lot unless you know that most of the dancers here are over 70.
No. What time are we performing?
Yeah, at 11 o'clock. In the new facility, fifth floor, Asian section.
The group came together 9 years ago. Cynthia Yi, who used to dance at the Chinese Sky Room, was at a senior center dance class. Yi is an active member of the Chinese American community, and at the time, she was helping to plan a fundraiser for Chinese Hospital in Chinatown.
And so I said, come on, let's do a night in at the Forbidden City nightclub.
How high the ocean, how high the moon.
All of them had great memories of performing in the clubs, the glittering stage lights, the sassy costumes, meeting all kinds of new people every night. So, the four former showgirls, then in their 50s and 60s, put together a number for the event.
We were an instant hit. And it was so much fun. We said, oh, let's do another one. And that's how it all began.
The troupe now performs at senior centers, nursing homes, VA hospitals, and fundraisers all over the world. And they've expanded from the original four former professionals to include people from all walks of life, a retired pharmacist, a school teacher, a dentist.
Every time we would do a fundraiser or get together, people would come up to us, oh my gosh, do you know I've always wanted to be a dancer, but my mother and father would never allow me to take dancing lessons. And I said, well, come on, let's get to the senior center. You're retired now, and let's start dancing.
Yi grew up in Chinatown in the 50s.
I grew up on Beckett Street. It's an alleyway right off of Jackson. And then I was about 10 years old, we moved up the hill to Powell and Clay. And then my mom still lives on Powell and Clay, except in a different building.
Her upstairs neighbors were dancers and entertainers who worked at the nightclubs. And one night, her parents took her to the biggest and most popular of the Chinese clubs, Charlie Lo's Forbidden City.
That's when I first saw, you know, Dorothy Toy and Wing dance, and that's when I fell in love.
Dorothy Toy and Paul Wing were known as the Chinese Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and Dorothy Toy just happened to be one of Cynthia Yee's neighbors. When she was 7, Toy encouraged her to go to ballet classes. And when she turned 17, Toy asked her to join the show at the Sky Room.
See that up there? That's the Chinese Sky Room. Where the stained glass is, that's the Chinese Sky Room. And inside had beautiful, wonderful antique chandeliers. And that's where I danced.
Where the Sky Room used to be is now a conference room for the Grant Plaza Hotel. The former site of Forbidden City now houses a franchise of the Barbizon Modeling School. And though she still spends a lot of time in Chinatown, Yi lives in the Richmond now. There's a large Chinese population there. And every Wednesday, there are the Grant Avenue Follies, rehearsing at the Rec Center on 18th Avenue. Ivy Tam is one of the group's original members. She performed at the Forbidden City in the early 60s, but before the Follies, she hadn't danced for many years. She says she's happy to have returned to dancing now at age 78, and especially happy to be able to bring back good memories for other seniors who aren't as spry.
At least when we perform, make them a little happier. That's one thing I can do. You know, if not, what I can do for them? Nothing. I think our little entertainment, make them happy for that day. That will be way good feeling for me.
Tam says she also enjoys seeing the surprise on people's faces when they realize what kind of show they're in for.
I can tell if they don't know us, they never see before, they expect we doing just the Chinese dancing, right? And little fan, little, you know, and things like that. They don't think we will do tap, we will do hula, we will do anything.
Tam's specialty is a dance with giant feather fans that always wows the audience. And that's not all.
And those days when people look at it, really is kind of, you know.
Pretty sexy.
Sexy, uh-huh. But they like it, though.
They love it. They love our fishnet stockings. I mean, definitely. Nowadays, you know, when we come out in our fishnet stockings, we don't even have to get to the stage yet. People are like, whoa, they start applauding.
Both dancers agree on the best part about being with the Grand Avenue Follies.
But what makes us different really is the sisterhood that we keep.
The ladies socialize, travel, and eat huge Chinese restaurant meals together. They drive each other to appointments and watch out for each other's health. They say it's good to have that sense of family with the group, especially now that they can't find it in Chinatown. With waves of successive immigration from very different areas of China, and younger generations moving out of the neighborhood and even out of the city, the place just doesn't feel the same anymore.
People before is like big family. My mother was very sick. She had cancer. I take her to treatment every day or something. And those grocery store, they will ask, how's your mother? And then when if she's sitting in the car, and then they will go out to say hello to her.
Every apartment, we knew each other in the lobby. I don't think you have that nowadays. You know, it's not as close. My mother still lives in Chinatown, and she's very fortunate that her building is, you know, very close-knit. But in general, I don't believe that, you know, you see that anymore.
Yi hopes that the Grand Avenue Follies can bring some of the feeling of that old Chinatown back, at least for those that remember it. But she's also thinking ahead.
It's my dream to have a small venue, small place in Chinatown, to have the best wonton mein, wonton noodles, and the downstairs cellar to be a live entertainment area, and to have people to be able to come back to Chinatown, second generation, third generation, fourth generation, where they feel comfortable. And say, wow, my grandfather used to live here, and they want to see the place. They want to experience the old Chinatown flavor.
For now, the ladies of the Grant Avenue Follies are bringing that flavor back, one song and dance at a time. In San Francisco, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
Okay. So you go out and meet the audience. Put this under your left.
Jen reported that story in 2015, but you can catch the Grant Avenue Follies this weekend. They'll perform this Saturday at Chinatown's Autumn Moon Festival. For more information, go to klw.org/crosscurrents. Tune in Monday morning at 11. We head to the Delta to find an invisible line where salt water meets fresh water.
The further west you go from here, the saltier it gets. And until you're out in the bay and then ultimately the ocean.
Our new series about the four most elemental ingredients of life and how they're being reshaped by climate change. Monday morning at 11. Today's CrossCurrents team includes Steffi Puerto, Cheryl Kaskowitz, James Rollins, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Mary Catherine O'Connor, Shirin Adil, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For CrossCurrents, I'm Hanat Baba.